Hey, everybody, welcome back. We're back after the craziness of holidays and life. It's taken us a while to find a moment to come together again.
Hi, guys.
So we're here today with the topic of secularism, which, as we have been doing our research, is a vast topic, and we're probably only going to scratch the surface today. We could probably talk about this for weeks. But we're going to do our best.
Yeah, it's great to be with you guys again. Thanks for listening. And hopefully, you might be able to relate to, at a minimum, you might be able to relate to a lot of the things that we're going to talk about today, because secularism really maybe best be defined as this really is, in our culture, this is the air we breathe, you know, and so some of it is hard to even detect because we're so accustomed to it and so used to it. And so it's kind of fun for that reason. It's like, this is actually what we're in. A lot of the worldviews we talk about, you know, are not necessarily as common or as applicable as this one. So this one is pretty common for us.
Yeah. It's like being able to put color in the air and actually see the air we breathe or something. Which I think is valuable. Because it's, I think it's rare, at least for me, that I actually stop and take stock of the soup I'm swimming in and actually see what's in it. So we're just going to start, as always, with just a simple definition. If you were to just look up secularism on Wikipedia, here is what you would read. Secularism is the principle of seeking to conduct human affairs based on naturalistic considerations, uninvolved with religion. As a philosophy, secularism seeks to interpret life based on principles derived solely from the material world without recourse to religion. It shifts the focus from religion towards temporal and material concerns. A major issue concerning or considered by secular philosophy is the nature of morality in a material universe. Secular ethics and secular morality describe systems of right and wrong that do not depend on religious or supernatural concepts. Much of the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche is developed in response to this issue. Under secular ethics, good is typically defined as that which contributes to human flourishing and justice, which I think is really interesting, rather than an abstract or idealized conception of good. Secular ethics are often considered within the frame of humanism. Do you want to say anything more about just general definition of secularism?
Yeah, sure. What we have been learning is that secularism itself, and it kind of depends on who you ask, kind of takes some different shape in terms of definition. And largely that would be, you know, sort of dependent on maybe your own worldview, like where you come from. So not everyone reacts the same way to the word secularity or to secularism. I'm going to read for a second out of a book by Ronald Rollheiser, who has become one of my favorite authors, and it's called Secularity and the Gospel. But here he sort of defines a little bit, which this might be relatable kind of on a street level for us. So he says, for some, secularity or secularism, it connotes most everything that is good, like what Amira just sort of described. Freedom, equality, human dignity, rationality, democracy, the move beyond irrational fear and superstition, the possibility of science, the opposite of fundamentalism, and an opening of the human mind and spirit that should appropriately be spoken of as an enlightenment. For them, secularity helped end the Dark Ages, the burning of witches, the Inquisition, and the feudal world with its systems of unfair privilege and narrow religious intolerance. In this view, secularity is more friend than enemy, and it is a major moral achievement bought at a considerable price that should not naively be taken for granted, nor challenged too uncritically in the name of God and religion, which sometimes it is, and again, depending on your circle. So, yeah.
So I think it's important to name up front that secularism in and of itself is actually in some ways a really good idea. There's Jeremy Rodell identifies three core principles of secularism, which are institutional separation, meaning separation of church and state, freedom of belief, and no discrimination on the grounds of religion, and that these conditions allow for competing concepts of the good life to be pursued in society. It goes as far back as to ancient Greece, where city-states adopted secular practices by separating legislative and community affairs from those of the Greek gods and goddesses. And it wasn't until the founding of the United States, actually, that an explicitly secular country was first established.
Yeah.
The Constitution actually states in the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So secular doesn't necessarily have negative connotations. Like in government, it protects us from a state-supported church, which could then force us to practice a particular religion. Force is, you know, never rooted in love or freedom, and this country was founded on the you know, value of freedom.
Yeah.
In his book, Secularism, Politics, Religion, and Freedom by Andrew Copson from Oxford, he says that he argues secularism is our best way to achieve civic harmony while protecting the right to religious freedom. He relies on the concise definition by French scholar Jean Bobereau, I think is how you say him, that the separation of religious institutions from institutions of state, the freedom of conscience for all individuals, circumscribed only by the need for public order and the respect of the rights of other individuals, and no discrimination by the state against individuals on the basis of our beliefs, that these are all like the essential components to do away with, you know, government oppression.
Yeah.
And so those things are really important to keep in mind, because at, I think, the core of this, it sort of became infused into society as a really important thing, as a really good idea.
Yeah.
It did away, you know, as like Jenna was saying, it kind of did away with the age of religious wars. And, you know, John Locke said, and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, they knew full well that one predictable consequence of state-sponsored religion was that states would go to war over religion.
Yeah.
Which is a really ugly thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The freedom for religion, you know, the separation of church and state is also, you know, honoring that it's freedom for religion, meaning all religions. And so that is so important. You know, a byproduct of this whole, I mean, of America as an experiment, you know, it was an experiment becoming the first real secular, eventual country, full country. Is that did create a division that was unique in a lot of ways between the church and the state, which you know, most of us know that, but it also created a little bit of a divide in terms of philosophically, in sort of a mainstream the human I guess sort of the like a mainstream way of thinking about things that were religious functions and things that were public sphere functions, or like, so it kind of did create a bit of a divide though for people who were used to having their lives integrated in the public sphere between religion, acts that were religious, and in their public life. So now there's a bit more of a divide for a lot of people between, you know, their public life and their private life. And that's sort of just, in reflection, that's sort of a byproduct of secularism, is there's a bit of a division, you know, for a lot
and
of
that's
people.
Pretty new historically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually very new in some ways, except for the Greek situation. But I think it's also interesting to look at a little more of the history. I was reading about Thomas Paine, who wrote this pamphlet called Common Sense, that predated the Declaration of Independence, and it was actually the most widely read work in the Western world after only the Bible. And he was a major proponent of revolution. So this pamphlet helped rally the American, you know, revolution against Britain. This, you know, helped get people on board and ready. But Thomas Paine was a major proponent of revolution. And in this book, it says a vitriolic critic of organized religion also. So he had this incredible influence. He's called the patron saint of an eclectic assortment of 19th and 20th century free thinking, agnostic, atheist, humanistic, and secular individuals and organizations. who wanted not just for the old religions to wither and die, but to found a new, quote, this is called a religion of humanity, a church of humanity, that would replace them. It says, the world is my country, to do good, my religion. The world is my country, to do good, my religion. So had written the founding father of American free thought, Thomas Paine. So, you know, and he's with a whole cast of similar thinkers, both foreign and American, all that were on board with creating this new religion of humanity, that proposed really mankind as the proper object of human reverence and devotion. So I think at the core, secularism is this, what they call the religion of humanity. It's really putting self, putting humanity, people, on the throne, essentially, putting them as this sort of sovereign, how would you want to put that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, authority.
What it would be like, what was formerly understood as authoritative would be scripture or divine. Now the authority is the self. So yeah. A God substitute, you know, modern God substitute.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really important thing as like a grounding for what we're going to talk about for the rest of this podcast. Yeah. Is that that's, if I feel like if we were to boil down the definition of secularism, it would be that. It would be self as authority.
Yeah.
Or humanity as authority.
Yeah.
Would you say that's true?
I think that is true. Yeah. Yeah, I think when, you know, secularism as sort of defined here, and of course, like we said, it's sort of, it depends on who you ask, how it is defined, but at a minimum, it's religious skepticism. Mm-hmm. And so then if, you know, the point at which an entire culture becomes skeptical of divine authority, then there's, you know, there's only so many options, you know, at that point, then it becomes the next natural authority, you know, sort of begins with the self. And then our American culture lends itself nicely because we love liberty and we love freedom. And so it lends itself nicely to that being an option, is that the self can become the primary compass, you know, governing all decisions about morality. Whereas, you know, in eras past, it would be that authority or morality was handed down, identity was handed down. And so in a secular culture, if those are not baseline assumptions, where tradition or religion were things that previously handed those things down, then, like I said, it just kind of creates, there's sort of a spectrum of options then, and the self certainly has become one of the options. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, with the self as the authority, there's a lot of selves.
Mm-hmm. A lot of selves with a lot of authorities.
With a lot of different ideas about authority. And so we'll talk more about this later, but then we're looking at then popular consensus becoming the new grounding for what's right and wrong. Mm-hmm. Did you want to say more about any of that before I jump into?
Yeah. Yeah. So my primary interest in assessing a lot of the worldviews is I'm trying to, like a lot of us, I think this is probably similar for a lot of you, is that we are trying to understand the varying worldviews from a variety of perspectives. You know, it's easy to get in our tunnels. That's true for everybody. And so one of the other perspectives that's been interesting, and I would just say this is something that I really relate to on just like a personal lived experience level, is that my experience of secularism coming from maybe academia down, social circles down, not just a skepticism of religion, which is actually, I don't have a ton of critique of that actually, because in truth, there's reason to critique a lot of things, but not just religion, but has been sort of my lived experience was not just a skepticism of religion, but an outright hostility to particularly Christianity. So I think most of our listeners know that Amir and I do come to these conversations as Christians, but we're interested in dissecting all these ideas from a variety of perspectives. But one of the things that I have sort of realized is, when talking about secularism, you'll get some like Christian circles, for example, who just fully denounce, can't stand the idea of secularism, because of some of its downsides. And namely, when the self has become authority that is problematic, especially from a biblical worldview for a lot of reasons, when the self becomes maybe, like I said, sort of a God substitute or the highest authority, there can, and as demonstrated in a variety of pathologies, can be troublesome and really difficult. But one thing that's interesting is that one thing that's taken for granted in a secular culture is that a lot of the roots that we take for granted come from specifically a Judeo-Christian worldview. And yet that's very much what's also dismissed, or like there's a frustration, sort of a culture-wide frustration with antiquity when it comes to the Judeo-Christian worldview. But it's kind of one of those things that you can't have it all. Like, we have a root system that kind of allowed the conditions to create a secular society. And so I'm just going to read this again out of Rollheiser's book. I just thought this was really interesting. An apt image to describe how so many people within secular culture, wanting to be mature and sophisticated, relate to our Judeo-Christian roots and the churches. Nurtured in a culture that was born largely out of a Judeo-Christian womb, many stand at the edges of their religious heritage, hypercritical about the religious family they've been born into, and convinced that their Christian roots are what stand between them and proper freedom, achievement, and enjoyment. Whether it's expressed or not, and so my lived experience, just to bump in here, was that it was very expressed, that sense was very expressed. This is the spirit that undergirds much of the anti-Christian, anti-ecclesial, and anti-clerical feeling within our time. But I think what I want to point out is that I think my perspective, and I know where Amir and I come from, is that we don't view secularism as all bad, but it is one of those things that to be wise stewards of the moment that we're born into, right, in our culture, in our context, in the time that we're in, is to be mindful and respectfully critical of the ideas. And a lot of the ideas in secular culture are beautiful things, like really beautiful things that have come out of secularity. And yet it's very, very difficult to arrive at things like justice and human dignity in a full departure away from its Judeo-Christian root system. And so that is a primary place of, I think, emphasis for me, is that we very much love and claim those beautiful things like justice and human dignity, all of which we believe in and love, and I think most of us would agree upon, and even non-judgment. And yet those things are very hard to logically arrive at in a comprehensive worldview with a full departure from Christianity. And so one of my favorite cultural commentators, and he's a historian and an author, he's an author, but he's also a teacher in Australia, Mark Sayers. He said that very much what a lot of sociologists see in the West is that we have this tendency to really love and elevate high principles such as justice, you know, like and human dignity, the things that are very demonstrated through the scriptures, the biblical narrative, as being aspects of the kingdom of God, to use the language of scripture. But in the West, we love the kingdom of God, but just without the king in scripture. And so we want the fruit of the tree that is, you know, that root system, but a departure from its named king. And so that is just one observation of, you know, the secular West, sort of. And that's specifically, of course, coming from a biblical worldview, but we're here to discuss it from a lot of angles. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I think maybe that's a good segue into looking a little deeper, or defining a little bit more of the assumptions as they stand right now in secular culture. Mm-hmm. Natasha Crane wrote a book called Faithfully Different. And in this, she outlined these four kind of tenets of the secular worldview. So I'm going to name these tenets and then kind of unpack them just a little bit, because I think this is really valuable. Because this, again, is like the soup we're in, right?
Yeah.
The first one she said is feelings are the ultimate guide. The second one is happiness is the ultimate goal. The third one is judging is the ultimate sin. And the fourth one is God is the ultimate guess. So as I was going through these, I was like, wait, I actually think this is true. As working often unexamined assumptions about the world that mm-hmm. we're existing in right now. Yeah. So for example, feelings are the ultimate guide. Assumptions, of cultural messages like follow your heart, it's always right, or assume that you should be led by how you feel because feelings are the most reliable guide to what you should do in your life. This, we hear these things in society, like your heart's always right, or, things like that. Mm-hmm. This is the ultimate appeal to self-authority because only you know how you feel, right? Mm-hmm. So only you can guide yourself if feelings indeed take priority. In essence, you are your own self-sufficient expert on reality. Which I would say, by and large, this is what we believe as a society right now. And if, because nobody can look in on my inner world, therefore I am the ultimate authority of my life, right? Yeah. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, yeah, just, how in previous generations and certainly in other cultures, how there had almost always been an assumption that we receive like standards for like sort of how to live or just different things from the outside of us. I think that is maybe my only real point I want to make is that historically humans have understood that something outside of us has bearing and almost, and oftentimes authority over or like what we do with our inner man, what happens on the inside of us, almost like a subjugation of our inner worlds to this exterior outer truth. And so we're in a secular culture, which is skeptical of religion, but we're also in a postmodern culture that basically then asserts that relativity, is like truth, as truth is relative, right? I mean, that's the best way to, it's like you can impose truth onto anything that you wish, as opposed to there being an objective reality mm-hmm. through which or over which or under which, all of the above that we base our life on or that we mm-hmm. subjugate our lives to. And so when it comes to the inner person, our inner worlds, where our heart is now assumed as the source of truth, wherever that leads you, and that leads you to feelings and to, living in the subjective as truth. Mm-hmm. But in former generations, that was never understood as a viable way mm-hmm. to live in alignment with human flourishing. It was understood that the self is a fickle God because we ebb and flow. And the same way, though, that consensus, though, ebbs and flows. So it's tricky when you have an entire society that is now mainstream built upon the idea that popular consensus governs morality as opposed to an objective moral law, which assumes then an objective moral lawgiver. But it just creates this whole really interesting dynamic for personal morality, but then how your personal morality can not really correspond always with public, I guess with the governing authorities. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just kind of lays some really tricky groundwork for mm-hmm. how to be authentic and real, but also be part of a larger society and how a bunch of selves do that together.
Right. And I think there's some irony in this because, again, back to that original definition, it says under secular ethics, good is defined as that which contributes to human flourishing and justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're basically saying that, human flourishing comes from following your feelings as your ultimate guide, which I'm not sure any of us, when looking at that objectively, would agree with that.
Yeah. Right.
Because we all know that when we follow our heart every single time, it doesn't always lead to human flourishing.
Yeah.
Right? We have a lot of desires that actually lead to the opposite. So I'm going to move on to happiness is the ultimate goal. I think that I talk about this in counseling a lot with people who come in and really feel like they're failing because they're not quote unquote happy all the time.
Yeah.
And so we have to do a lot of dismantling of a worldview that props up happiness as the ultimate goal. and to actually look at, is that realistic? Is that even good? And what is happiness? What actually is it? Because happiness really is just a feeling.
Mm, yeah.
It's just a feeling that comes and goes, just like sadness or frustration or anger. It's just a passing feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very subjective feeling.
Yeah.
And it's a very manipulatable feeling.
Yeah.
And it's a feeling that is can be, I want to almost say fake, like it can be given through, you know, chocolate. It can be given through these various avenues that make you feel happy for a moment, but it's not a lasting feeling. So, you know, Natasha Crane says that in this view, the only measure of life success is whether a person has been in touch with their feelings enough to know and pursue what would make them happiest. So again, this is from the root system of feelings as the ultimate guide. If you're in touch with them enough and then know it would make you happy and then get that thing to make you happy, right? I think it's interesting. I don't want to bash Glennon Doyle in any way, but she is sort of in culture today kind of known as like the patron saint of like female empowerment, I would say.
Totally, yeah.
And she talks about how we like to find and honor your true self as only defined by you. Right. And themes are like happiness involves courageously leaving behind any external expectations or boundaries or goals in order to be true solely to yourself. And that's what's strong, inspiring. That's what's self-aware and worthy of the greatest praise in secular culture.
Mm-hmm.
You are the boss. So again, with my clients, often we'll talk about like what might be a goal, an ultimate goal that maybe is more satisfying or fulfilling than just happiness.
Yeah.
Things like a deeper peace or joy, which actually can hold sorrow with it. It's a deeper thing. It's not just a feeling.
Yeah.
It's a posture of gratitude for what you have in life, what you've been given, or, you know, service or fulfillment. You know, there's these other things that can be a goal other than just happiness. Also, just pursuing happiness does lead to sometimes a certain kind of hedonism where we're really after pleasure and we interpret it as happiness and we interpret that as good or the ultimate goal. Did you want to say anything about that?
I mean, I think the sort of obvious problem with that is just kind of like already just what you said is that when we base even things like our happiness on... or if it's contingent on circumstance. And so, like you said, we sort of have to define happiness. If we base happiness on circumstances or this, whatever your version of the utopian moment that you have to arrive at or the utopian circumstances you have to arrive at in order to have that thing, life has this way of butting us up against reality. That is that there's just things out of our control. And so if happiness is not achieved, then who are we or how do we arrive at some place of contentment and or joy, but primarily peace. I would put peace higher actually than even joy. Yeah. How do we maintain peace and weather storms well if everything is hinged on happiness or the pursuit of happiness?
So, and ironically, if we're always pursuing happiness, more often than not, we are experiencing a sense of failure.
Yeah. And, you know, in much of course, the Judeo-Christian womb that Rollheiser mentioned that the West is born out of, but also, or that I would say the American West is born out of, a lot of the sort of classical Greek philosophers, and certainly by the time that theologian Thomas Aquinas was delving into Greek thought and philosophy, so he was working with Aristotle's philosophy, also Plato's philosophy, and that time, basically they understood. So the Greeks, not meaning non-Christian Greeks, but then to the point of Thomas Aquinas, he had sort of a Christian Aristotelian sort of interpretation of Greek thought. But what was fundamental about all of their agreement was that there was this teleological foundation to the human person, that we were ordered towards a purpose. And that, and so then if Thomas Aquinas takes it further, the idea was that all creation, even humans, was ordered toward relationship with God, so that part of our purpose, or a telos, the teleological view of the human person, is that there's just more beyond the self, is that we, our actual bodies and spirits are ordered to something beyond the self. And if all of creation, so that was certainly Aristotle's view, is that that nature was good, the human body good, all of creation good, but that it also assumed a purpose. And so it's tricky if your whole entire telos becomes about finding happiness, because that's just a mixed bag of feelings. It's just the subjective.
Entirely self-focused.
Yes.
Yeah. Which eliminates then the relational aspect of the purpose of human beings,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the next one is judging is the ultimate sin. And I think this one is really important to look at.
Yeah.
Because I know I feel this on a regular basis personally. Mm-hmm. So this assumption, the assumption here is that if you want to love and help someone, that entails two things. One, it entails affirming their chosen path. And two, it entails affirming the nature of what happiness means to them.
Mm.
Okay. So questioning the path or nature of anyone's chosen happiness is completely off limits.
Yeah.
That's judgmental, and it's equated with actually hate.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you question what somebody else has chosen as their path to happiness, then you are seen as being hateful.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, back to happiness is the ultimate goal and feelings are the ultimate guide. So these all sort of like build on each other. They're dependent on each other. There's this example called harm reduction philosophy in some examples of like working with people who are homeless, resulting in things like Seattle's Downtown Emergency Service Center. They literally pass out heroin pipes and what's called booty bumping, which is like this administration kit that's considered maybe more safe or something to help prevent some infectious diseases and things. And there's pamphlets, and this might be like TMI, but there's literally the handout pamphlets that say, if your veins are hard to hit, then, you know, use this instead or whatever. So on one hand, they're trying to reduce harm, which is good. But on another hand, it's based in, you know, we have no place to say that even somebody doing heroin to pursue happiness is necessarily wrong.
Right. Right? 'Cause there's no end. I mean, as soon as it is the Pandora's box, because as soon as you walk down that road as a governing philosophy, because mm-hmm. then if you apply it mainstream and it goes society wide, there is no, like, what is actually the barometer for truth or for what's right or good?
Right.
You know, it's...
And so it eliminates the possibility that any kind of criticism can be constructive.
Yeah.
So the more we hear from culture that judging someone else's choices is wrong always, the more we feel affirmed that any criticism we receive is like ill-conceived. It's like mm-hmm. not okay, right?
Yeah.
But that to me eliminates the ability for us to grow and yeah. to question each other and to be accurate reflections for each other,
yeah.
Which is really important.
So important, yeah.
So then the last one is God mm-hmm. is the ultimate guess. And this is really big too. So, you know, again, we live in a culture right now where science is set up as the only evidence that we receive through science is able to contribute to our definition of anything that's true, right? Mm-hmm. So the assumption that it cannot be known with any confidence that God exists is this God is the ultimate guess, right? So there's two conflicting ideas that come out here. One is, the first is the superficially friendly idea that all roads lead to God or that all religions are equally true. So if God's the ultimate guess, then all religions are equally true, right? This belief is right at home with the secular sort of trifecta of following your heart, seeking happiness, and not judging.
Mm-hmm.
There's no certainty, only comfortable guesswork that ensures that no one can ever be wrong. So once again, the individual maintains this ultimate authority, and the secular messages are so attractive because we all share, you know... Well, this is from a biblical worldview that would say we all share this nature that desires self-rule.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll go into that later. But basically, this is what we want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
We want to hear that we're right. We want to hear that we can't be wrong. So this is all pointing to something that I might say is will ruffle feathers. It ruffles mine even a little bit, mm-hmm. that says that secularism is actually not neutral at all. We really assume that in keeping with the church-state separation, that there's a way to create a worldview neutral public sphere. But there is actually no such thing.
Yeah.
We cannot do it. And that's where I think this is tricky, because for a lot of people, you know, for all of us living in this secular culture, the assumption really is like, oh, this is the way to do life in the public sphere neutrally, mm-hmm. and allow for all these ideas.
Yeah.
But we'll get in deeper to why that's not consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. Do we want to move on to morality?
Sure. Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay. So we're going to look at, because in secular culture, we have to have a way to deal with ethics and morality. Mm. We have to have something that helps us decide what's right and wrong. And so how do we decide that? So Natasha Crane has this pretty brilliant quote that says, without an objective basis for morality from, you know, we would say God, she says, a higher than human moral lawgiver, yeah. right? The closest thing secularists can have as a moral standard that applies to all people is only popular consensus.
Yeah.
So it's just popular consensus.
And you just have to think about that logically. There's no other alternative than that. Like, if morality is relative, there is no alternative other than common consensus, right. like the majority rules. And we know that's a slippery slope too.
It's a very slippery slope. Yeah. So she assumes that's why it's so important for secular culture to continually, she says, you know, push their views of morality through every channel, education, media, entertainment, business, and more. The more people get on board with any given view of morality, the more the popular consensus is achieved, right? And the more secularists have a new supposed standard for what's right. So, do you want to say more about that?
I think anyone who is even just roughly a student of history understands how the difficulty with public consensus as barometer for morality, because, I mean, just the most glaring in our most recent history example of that is the Holocaust, where you have thousands of people in agreement on a moral order that has catastrophic human casualty, right? But agreed upon. And so, I mean, and there's so many examples. Of course, our last 125 years, you know, the bloodiest in all of history, and it's exactly for that reason. And of course, there's a ton more to say about that and war and all those different things. But it is exactly that's when you think of ideas as having a root system, and if you think about each layer of ethics or morality having a root system in an idea, if you can convince an entire group of people who are, if there's a powerful majority, ideas, and I know we've said this in past ones, but I just swear by this because it always echoes as true. Like, true with a capital T is that ideas have consequences and bad ideas have victims. And so if you have an entire group of people who hop on the bandwagon of an idea that happens to have devastating consequences, our history demonstrates the error with mm-hmm. that as the metric for morality.
Yeah. That these things just start with an idea.
Yes, of course. Right. Yeah.
So here's the thing. Is that when we start looking at this from a different perspective, it's that secularism isn't able to fully stand on its own feet in the realm of morality. So a secular view of morality is one in which, like, everything is relative to individual preferences. Nothing is right and wrong for all people, right? That's what it stands on. However, that's actually not the functioning view of morality in secular culture today. Instead, our culture often believes it can and should determine what's right and wrong for everyone, but it's based on the shifting sands of popular consensus.
Right. Yeah.
So if you disagree with that popular consensus, she says, there's no pat on the back for following your heart. Right?
Yeah.
You can only follow your heart if it leads you to the same conclusions about morality as that popular consensus.
Yeah.
So again, this is not neutral.
Yeah. So a perfect, in my mind at least, a really demonstrable right in hometown experience is like the common thread, which is that we in our sort of secular progressive area that we live in, that tolerance and diversity are amongst the highest values. And we love those, by the way. We love that idea until you'll find someone who's an evangelist for those ideas, right? Like it's the highest values. So you'll have somebody who claims those things, but if they run into, for example, somebody with a traditional set of morals, like then all of a sudden it's actually not okay. You don't have tolerance for someone who follows their heart on their moral guidelines. It's just so tricky, because I think what I'm saying is nobody can actually really live within that, because you could even say, everyone, you just go do you. You follow your heart until someone following their heart led to them stealing your wallet. And then all of a sudden you have a problem with that person's moral order. Like, you know, everyone's cool with it until someone else's morality infringes on your sovereignty or your version of morality. And so there just has to be something beyond the self, beyond common, you know, consensus that you know, to display what law actually should be. So, of course, we have laws, but we're talking about morality, because we know that not all laws correspond with actual moral good or moral evil, because, yes.
Yeah. So this is, you know, morality shifts through time because it's not rooted in a standard. Mm-hmm. This is essentially Darwinism.
For like sure, the evolution time, of morality. Right? Yep.
So if we're no more than the product of blind chance, then we belong to ourselves and are the measure of all things, mm-hmm. just like Protagoras said, right? If, however, there's a supernatural creator who has brought us into existence and has specifically revealed our identity and purpose to us, we ignore that information at our own peril.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I want to just briefly mention, so back to the idea that secularism isn't neutral, and how that popular consensus is arrived at. And it, you know, it's in large part like who actually is in charge of dispatching these narratives also. And that's a whole other topic that we can't really get into, and nor would I know enough to go there. But I think it's important to actually name that. Mm-hmm. There's this really interesting study that Natasha Crane cited about these sociologists who research potential religious bias in the press. They provided a group of journalists these like sort of would-be stories with different scenarios, with the same scenarios but different key details. Mm-hmm. So as an example, one of the scenarios concerned a shooting inside a religious building. One group was told the building was a church, the other group was told the building was a mosque, for example. Or another story was about a professor making hateful comments. Half were told the comments were Christian phobic. The other half were told the comments were homophobic. Okay, so they found that the news outlets agreed to run the stories equally, but the differing details determined how the journalist talked about what happened. In the case of the homophobic professor, the press highlighted hate speech and whether the professor should be fired. In the case of the anti-Christian professor, the press highlighted the right to free speech. Similarly, in the case of the mosque shooting, the journalists focused on hate crimes and bigotry, while the case of the church shooting, they focused on the shooter. Hmm. So these editorial decisions like these are made thousands of times every day, and the collective outcome strongly shapes what we understand to be happening.
Yeah.
What's acceptable to talk about, what's important to talk about, what's normal to think. So, you know, back in the 1980s, we might see that, you know, there was, like I said, there's 50 different independent companies that own the majority of media in the U.S. But by 2011, just 6 conglomerates enrolled 90% of media. And imagine, you know, what that is now. So that's just to say, like, there are these narratives that are put out there. There are these biases that are supported and then kind of balloon.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. Okay. Should I mention the Satanic Temple?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let's do it. We're going there. We're going there.
Famous last words. Should I mention the Satanic Temple?
I will. Yes, I will. Okay, so I think this is just really interesting. So there is something called the Secular Student Alliance, the Collegiate Secular Student Alliance. So this is, again, last time we talked about these formation machines and higher education as a large one. Mm-hmm. So here's what this, it's called the SSA, Secular Student Alliance, says about itself. It says, it empowers secular students to proudly express their identity, build welcoming communities, promote secular values, and set a course for lifelong activism. Okay, this statement assumes, of course, this is from Natasha's book, that there is secular agreement on what good values are and that they're worth fighting for over a lifetime. So a quick look at their website actually shows that some of the organization's values include things like keeping abortion legal, advocating for further political separation of church and state, promoting diverse sexual lifestyles, planning events to highlight the supremacy of science and reason over faith. So, again, these are not necessarily neutral, and these are large assumptions about what does or does not contribute to human flourishing. Mm-hmm. So then we looked a little bit more into what the Satanic Temple is, which is sort of, it's a shocking title for some people maybe, but I was actually really surprised that it's actually an organization that exists to promote secularism. Mm-hmm. That isn't quote unquote a religious organization, mm-hmm. right? But it carries this name, which is fascinating. And the Satanic Temple, their tagline is empathy, reason, and advocacy. And in their mission statement, they say that they exist to encourage benevolence and empathy, to reject tyrannical authority, advocate practical common sense. Again, assuming that they know what common sense...
That it's agreed upon.
It's agreed upon.
Consensus.
Right? Oppose injustice and undertake noble pursuits, whatever that might mean.
We need definitions for noble. We also need definitions for justice. You know, that's the tricky...
And in general, they adhere to the principles of individual sovereignty. So again, the authority of the self. Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. Satanism loves secularism.
Sovereignty Seriously. Of the self.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yes, it is. So when we're looking at how we arrive at these things, I don't think it's a too far of a stretch to say that we look at evidence, but only in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So if we're assuming that science as it is today and the evidence that they're providing, or the way they're interpreting evidence, I guess is more accurate,
yeah.
Informs what society sees as truthful, we have to look at what is the evidence that we're looking at and how is it being interpreted?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, so why do some people respond differently to different evidence? So if you were to ask me, perhaps an atheist, if there's any evidence for God, they would say, absolutely not, there's none. And just as a little aside here, I think this was really interesting to me, is that if we're thinking about a God who created time, space, and matter, then that God has to be timeless, spaceless, and immaterial, yes. and therefore outside of all those things, where I can't speak, but science is measuring time, space, and matter.
Mm.
So the evidence that perhaps like atheistic scientists, materialistic scientists might be looking for God might not actually exist in the way they want it to, for example. But mm-hmm. anyway, so then if a Christian's asked, is there evidence for God? They would say, yeah, there's a lot. So, basically, evidence is a body of facts that just require human interpretation.
Yeah.
And because evidence requires this human interpretation, there will always be multiple possible explanations for it. Yeah. We should be asking, what is the most likely explanation given the evidence, right? But if we rule out certain possible explanations before considering the evidence, as in there is no God or the material is all there is, you know, that's ruling out an explanation before we consider the evidence, we won't ever conclude that the evidence points to those explanations.
Yeah.
So what happens when we rule out God before interpreting the evidence?
Mm-hmm.
The best explanation for a body of evidence is often debatable, and it's rarely certain.
Yeah.
And yet, in society, there are certain things that are seen as certain and seen as no longer debatable.
Yeah.
But that is only because we're interpreting the evidence with a set of presuppositions.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that even so, to bring it like super tangible in front of our faces, because I mean, no, that's all good. It's just that, you know, like it, for those of us observing, let's say, what the experts had to say over the last few years, even when it comes to the COVID pandemic, I think what she's getting at is exactly why we saw such a vast spectrum across expertise, like across the disciplines, of varying results on basis. So basically what we're saying is you can have all of the same data points, but then be read a different way. Mm-hmm. Like, and so that's, so everybody can be looking at the same evidence, but arrive at different conclusions. Sorry. And so I think that's where we have to understand that, I mean, a real scientist is probably not like a, I should say, not like a real scientist. I should say probably a deeply honest, really, really thorough scientist is likely not going to be someone who is going to delve into the realm of philosophy, but will find their conclusions and just say, this is what we observe now. Mm-hmm. Because the scientific revolution, which of course, like technology, was born in the West, also born out of the curiosity coming from the Judeo-Christian worldview. So all of that born, I think what it just shows us, I think it should just demonstrate this humility in all of us to say every single person, expert or not, I think that's, there's this book called The Death of Expertise, and it's exactly getting at what we're talking about, which is that you can have all these people across disciplines in all these tremendous fields of study, and yet all read data points in a different way. And that's because everybody comes to the table with a different set of biases, but just meaning assumptions, predispositions and assertions about, like, basically the undergirding truths about what's true and what's real. Because, you know, if you come to something that you see in science, for example, like, let's say some artifact or like, I don't know, something that they see in nature, and you come to that with the assumption that there was a flood, like a flood at the beginning, then all of a sudden your reading of those data points are going to be completely different than if you come to that exact same fossil, let's say it's a fossil, mm-hmm. with the assumption that everything evolved and there is no starting place of the flood. So just, it's just, it really does matter what your assumptions are when it comes to science, but all areas of, you know, study mm-hmm. and discipline and expertise.
Totally.
So, yeah.
It makes me think of the cosmological argument for God,
nice.
Which I love,
which
is actually really quite simple,
mm-hmm.
Which says basically that the universe began to exist, and that in and of itself is a mainstream scientific consensus.
Yeah,
that the universe had a beginning,
began to
exist.
Mm-hmm. Like there was nothing, and then there was something. Yeah,
right. And so then everything that begins to exist has a cause. So nothing pops into existence on its own. And that's mm-hmm. something we know also is true scientifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Therefore, it's like an A plus B equals C, right? Therefore, the universe must have had a cause.
Mm.
So in order to create time, space, and matter, the cause would have to be, again, timeless, spaceless, and immaterial, and really powerful. So that's just, again, it's like, you know, science today in secular culture will say there was a beginning to the universe. Yes, things that begin to exist have a cause, but then there's not that next logical assertion that says, okay, then the universe had to have a cause.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say that, like, generally faith in culture today is seen as being opposed to reason.
Mm-hmm. Or similarly, that faith and science are incompatible.
Totally.
In the same way.
Yeah. That's, I would say, popular consensus is that those two things can't exist together.
Yeah. We disagree.
But we disagree. But part of the most important commandment, actually, that Jesus put forth is to love the Lord your God with all your mind, with your heart and your soul and your being and your might, but your mind. He put the mind in there.
Yeah.
writer and philosopher Vince Vitale pointed out that all the words used in the Book of Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament, these are all just in this one book. Reasoning, arguing, persuading, examining, debating, disputing, explaining, defending, refuting, convincing, and even proving. And that's just one book in the Bible. On top of that, in the New Testament, when it refers to someone's conversion, it always says they were persuaded, meaning they used their mind.
And also the process of that Paul outlines in the New Testament for the regeneration of the mind, the renewal of the mind, just that, you know, to use Scripture's lens, it's that the process of, Scripture calls it sanctification, but of basically aligning ourselves more with the Creator God is through the process of the mind, through the renewal of the mind.
Right.
So, you know, we place a high value on the mind.
On the mind,
sure.
And which means also reason.
Yep.
He says that the Bible says God has given, quote unquote, proof by raising Jesus from the dead. So here we're getting into some biblical understandings, but I think it's an interesting conversation to have. So that's a really bold and also a very, well, some would argue falsifiable claim. He says, before we argue for this historical occurrence, to also look at what other paths cite as reasons to believe. So I know we've been talking about secularism, but I think it's also important to look at some other religions and worldviews in this conversation too, because as we'll see in a second, there are some commonalities here.
Before we dive on that, I think those two, we had, well, before we had opened up the podcast, we were talking about these statistics that are just probably the most fascinating, if I'm being blunt, complete and utter irony of the secularist script in the West. And that is that while we've concluded in the scientific realm, so let's say that mainstream science has concluded that there's no God, right? So we are operating out of the Darwinian evolution assumption, that reading of the data points. And yet, and so that's obviously what trickles down from academia down into the mainstream, into the public sphere. However, it is completely ironic that it turns out that while we claim that, like in terms of like hierarchical objective data, that's what our culture would say is objective, somehow we are seeing that humans are not escaping the need, that felt sense need for the sacred realm, for the spirituality. So we need it. It turns out that humans need that. Yeah.
Right.
Hammer
off
those statistics.
So the matter, like secularism as a matter of worldview authority, doesn't actually imply atheism.
Right.
So from Pew Research, and this book was written in 2022, so this is really pretty recent data, only 10% of Americans say they don't believe in a higher power or a spiritual force. Only 10%, which means 90% of people believe something or someone exists out there.
Yeah.
90%. Yeah. That's almost everybody.
Yeah, that's huge.
So to break it down further, the research showed that 74% of Americans say they actually talk to their God or higher power. So they believe there's a personal being or relational being. Mm-hmm. 56% believe their God or higher power is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving, even if it's not the God of the Bible. Mm-hmm. 42% believe spiritual energy is located in physical things like mountains. 41% believe in psychics. 33% believe in reincarnation. And 29% believe in astrology.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting that secularism is totally ready to accept like more generic gods per se. And Natasha Crane says, you know, gods that require nothing of us, but not a specific one that requires everything, which I think is really important to think about. But I also thought that was really illuminating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very telling.
We're about to run out of time. So we're going to pause here and we're going to do a part two. So come back. And I think we have some really important things to talk about at the end here.
Yeah. Okay.